Right. One briefly. And just so you understand the difference between the Talmud Yerushalmi and Talmud Bavli. And then the others we're going to spend more time on is because they're cited all the time and their commentaries are cited all the time. So it's not important not necessarily how they look or what they look like, but just that they exist, where they came from.
Oh.
And I looked at the material before I came, and I think we will be able to finish tonight.
Oh, okay. Oh,
okay.
Is it the last class?
It could be if we finish.
Okay.
If we don't, but you know, if you have questions and we're kind of stuck on something, that's fine. You know.
Just got back.
Welcome back.
Can I borrow your pen? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I have a pen.
Thank you.
It's from Sacramento.
It's a very special pen.
Yeah, you know how I got. You can turn this off. We're not going to start now. But you know how I got it. Actually,
I lost somehow the plane. I lost my
stylet.
Stylet. Yeah. So and I didn't have anything to write with. Literally handed down. That's what Masora means, to hand over, right? To give over. Was very very strong, meaning sure. There was no machlokes and there's no disagreement on what anything meant. If they didn't know a halachic answer, they knew all the parameters of it, and so they can. There would be one particular answer. And how we know that is, we know, I think it was in Chagiga we talked about, right? The Gemara in Chagiga, which argues on whether or not a person is supposed to lean and put their weight on a carbon when it's a carbon Chagiga, which a carbon Chagiga falls on Yom Tov, routinely. It doesn't have to be, but that's the best time to give it. It could be any time during Chag, during time during the entire Chag, San Shavuos, it has to be Yom Tov, it's only one day. But on the other two, it could be during Chol HaMoed. But if it falls out on Yom Tov, which is the best thing we want to do, it's the reason Magdim la Mitzvah, we want to do the Mitzvah as fast, as early as possible. So the Chagiga is brought. The question is, on all the carbonos that are brought of the time, the voluntary carbonos, so we do put a smicha on it, right? On the Achatos, on all the other ones, we lean on it. But there's a sense of using an animal. So the rabbis had a discussion, do you do that with the Chagiga? Because they're almost like a form of support, right? You're not supposed to use animals on Yom Tov. So there was a machlokas, and it's brought the machlokas. The machlokas is brought in the names of two of the people that we have in the Mishnah in Avos that we're familiar with. Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Hananya? No.
Ben Yochanan.
Right, so that's the machlokas. And we know those people because that's in the fourth Mishnah in Avos. So we can pretty much date that to when it was. It was certainly, you know, about maybe 100 years or so before the destruction of the temple. Until then, there was no machlokas. So these, in fact, we know who their students were because we have the whole list there. Right, so we can date it fairly well. I think it was in there is a Masechta Tainus, not the Masechta Tainus, there was actually a whole tractate of times in which people, tzaddikim, would fast. And this is one of them, the date that this machlokas actually occurred, because previous to this there was no machlokas. And we know that Hillel and Shammai themselves, not Beis Hillel Beis Shammai, but the Tanaim themselves, had three disagreements, that's all. Basically, Beis Shammai had hundreds. And so what happened? And we talked about that last time. It was written down, the Mishnah was that oral law was eventually written down because the Machlokesim were increasing on not just an additive fashion, but an exponential fashion, and it had to be written down. It was felt by the leaders, by the leader, that if it wasn't written down, it would fall apart, we wouldn't know which way was up. So that's why it was written down. It was written down in case structure. If this were to happen, this is the din. If this were to happen, this was the din. We explained last week why the cases are weird cases. They're always unusual cases because that's how you learn the end of a principle, because on the other side of this gray line is black. The answer is clear, and it's no. Okay, but up till this, the answer might be yes, right? So even if it's this weird, it's still yes, all the more so. And we talked about that in the Torah itself. We have examples. Like we learn things out from unusual situations. Battlefield situations. We learn ethical laws, for example, and Sneas laws from being in war, not to waste things from being at war, because if you're even careful in that situation, how much more so when you're not at war and sitting the peace in your house. Okay. So we talked about the Mishnah, we talked about the Gemara. There's the Gemara. I wanted to make sure before we went on, this is a Gemara. This is a Talmud Bavli. When we call, well, basically almost always when you hear the word Gemara or Talmud,
Those two terms are synonymous. Talmud is Hebrew, from Talmud, Limud, right? Gemara is Aramaic. It means the same thing. And if you open it up, this is any tractate, they're very, very similar, although not identical. The basic is always the same. The middle is the Gemara. In certain sections, so you can find one quickly, you'll find where a Mishnah is. Beginning certainly it is, but I didn't want you to think that it's just in the beginning. So this is Brachos, right? So the beginning of every tractate has this little fancy thing on it, and in fact, every chapter has a little bit of not quite this fancy. Okay, then the Mishnah goes on until here it is, until here, where this is a Gimel Mem, which is short for Gemara. All right, so then the Gemara immediately starts asking questions here about this line, why this word was used, and how come it has it, you know, whose opinion is this? Well, it couldn't be his opinion, because way over here, you see his opinion is different, you see. So, and one of the things that's very difficult about learning Gemara is it always assumes you know every other page of Gemara. There is no start and end. It's not like a math book or any other textbook that you're familiar with, which, you know, it's always fun in the beginning, because it assumes you know nothing, right? And then you go through it. Right, but this does not assume you know nothing. It assumes you know the other books, all the other books. Not only that, but we're here, and not only that, but all the Sifri and all the other Midrashic material, because it always makes reference to that. So if you don't know, so that's what Rashi's about. On the inside of every page, and by inside I mean it's not left or right. There's two sides. So the inside of every page is Rashi, we'll talk about today, and on the outside is called Tosfos, which we'll talk about today. Those are called Rishoni. These are the early commentators, and they're very important, and we're going to talk about them today. Okay? We'll discuss them. Okay? So I'll make reference to this. This was finalized at approximately year 500, between 470 and 500 of the Common Era, in Babylonia. That's where the majority of the Jews lived, even at the time of the Second Temple.
When are you considering it finalized? Because I know, obviously, Rashi, you know...
Oh, no, there was no Rashi.
Yeah.
No, okay. I mean this. Okay. The Gemara itself.
So like Rav Ashi?
No. Yeah, Rav Ashi and Ravina.
Okay. Okay, so that's when it's considered finalized.
Yeah, that's when it's finalized in its fairly well-structured form, okay? But there was no, this other ancillary stuff, that came later. These are Rishonim. They couldn't have existed then, okay? The Yerushalmi, it's usually referred to as the Yerushalmi. It's not referred to as the Talmud, but it is the Talmud of Yerushalmi, and it's, or the Jerusalem Talmud, okay? It looks very similar, right? There's a little middle section, and then there's stuff at the end. But the middle section is fairly different. The commentaries on the sides are entirely different. There is no Rashi on the Yerushalmi, for example. Okay? So it's one of the few things he did have an elaborate commentary on. He had commentary on virtually everything. All of Tanakh, it's remarkable how much he wrote.
Who are the
other people? I really don't want to get into it. They're just extra names, but you can look at it later, and it says right here. Okay, I thought about it. It'll take us well off the path. These are not the commentary. Since we hardly ever learn Yerushalmi, then the commentaries on them are less well known. They're great, great people. You know, this was finalized. This was written in Jerusalem, Yerushalmi, or near Jerusalem, probably. In the suburbs of Jerusalem where they went after the temple, right before the temple was destroyed. So, and this was finalized like in the year 300, before that. And that's why this is used. This is much longer. There's much more discussion. There were people going back and forth between the two areas, between Babylonia and Eretz Israel. So they were in touch with one another. So this is the Babylonian Talmud is considered far more authoritative. If there's ever a machlokus, and there are, between the two, it's always the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud. So this is the main one. This is what's generally studied. This is what your sons will be learning in yeshiva, Net Hashem. But they don't learn this at all. You know, in some kololim, they start learning this a little bit. You know, so it's usually very advanced learning. Or if someone's putting together a shiur, and someone makes reference to this, and they'll go back and look at it. That's how people look at it. And the great, great, you know, when people get to the level of a Vilna Gaon, then they start going this, and they know this back and forth, and then they speculate, maybe that's the source for something, and, you know. It's a high-level stuff. But you'll hear about it because people make reference to it, okay? And we'll talk about these two in a little while. So that's the Gemara, okay? We'll come back to this, and then we'll talk about these two in a little while. when the Gemara, one of the main mistakes people make is they think once the Gemara was written down, then the Masorah is over. You know, then it's everything else is just like you just commentary, right? No. The Gemara was still strong, was still going on. With the misunderstandings and the discussions, what does it really mean? So, and that, in fact, it went on for close to another almost 1,000 years after the close of the Gemara. Okay. Yeah. The next group of people that are well known and worth knowing are called the Gaonim. In English, it would be G-A-O-N-I-M. Gaonim. A Gaon. You know, you may hear about Harav, Hagaon, so-and-so. It means the great one. In this case, it doesn't mean the great one. but that's what it means. A Gaon was the title given to the heads of the yeshiva in Babylonia. Okay, so if you were a head of the yeshiva, you were Harav, Hagaon, this, right? And they refer to today, historically, as the Gaonim. Right? So if you hear about that one, perhaps the most famous, is Rav Sadia Gaon, and they all had Aramaic names. Okay, that was a spoken language then, still. And there were three main yeshivas. The names aren't critical, but there were three main. One of which is probably worth knowing. Sura continued to exist until 1948. Believe it or not. So it was the longest standing yeshiva. If you think about it, it's remarkable. From the end of the first temple until 1948. You know, it was that yeshiva was going on, probably in different buildings, I suspect. But I mean, the same basic, you know, school. That's much longer than Cambridge, for example. You know, Cambridge is the longest lasting, you know, currently running, upper level university type thing. Oxford, Cambridge, Oxford.
Cambridge. Sura, Pumdisa, Mahoza?
No, that's another guy I figured, you know, I'm all. It's the other one is, no, it's.
No.
The name escapes me. It probably will hit me right as we leave. No. Okay, I don't know how they're ones. But then, okay, so those are two main ones. So when Rav and Shmuel, in fact, when they came, the first of the Amoraim were the latter after the time. So Rav and Shmuel were the Roshivas of, respectively, Sura and Pumbedisa. Right, so that's their two towns. Anyway, getting back to this. So the Gaonim continued the idea of Masorah, and they kept perpetuating it, and they taught their students it. Okay, and really, it was pretty solid at that point in time. And then something happened over the next 400 or 500 years. Because the Gaonim, I guess, would be going on for about the year 550, 560, till about almost the year 1000. At that time, the reason they were successful at what they were doing, and the reason the Babylonian, remember, this was all in Babel, so it really was a continuation of the Babylonian Talmud. They wrote it down, but activities continued. And the reason they were so successful there is that the secular government, the Babylonian Empire and whatever else was going on there, I forgot already my history, but the East was quite tolerant to Jews. And in fact, they encouraged the Jews to have their own sub-government. You know, govern themselves. If, God forbid, a Jew got into the problem with a non-Jew, then of course the local authorities would take care of it. However, anything between Jews, any matter that dealt with Jews, never went to the level of the secular government, that it was always dealt with the Jewish Bate Din, the rabbis, however we wanted to deal with it. There was never a discussion of how, they never told us how we have to deal with law, which was great. That's all we really wanted. You know, that's really all we wanted. Right? Leave us alone and we'll take care of everything, okay? And so that went well. There was something called the Reish Galusa, which, if you think about what the words mean, Reish is Rosh, Galus, you know, Galus. So it's the head of the exile. And it's a bit of a stretch because it really only meant the Babylonian exile. But really that was where the majority of the Jews lived. They lived everywhere, but that's probably most Jews live there, and certainly from a yeshiva and learning perspective, it was the tops. So it was the most established communities, and numerically and learning. So he was not, in fact, generally speaking, the head rabbinical figure, but he had a lot of respect, a lot of honor, and he usually was a Talmid Chacham. He would always go to the rabbinical leaders for halachic insight and general ideas, but he would be the king equivalent. But I guess the local authorities recognize there's never there wasn't a threat of him wanting to take over the government, which there wasn't, obviously. And but if you know Jewish history, that wasn't always the case. And much later, there was always either a perceived threat or a desired perceived threat. They wanted some sort of reason to pick on the Jews, and so this was as good as any. They're taking over the government. Yeah, I remember when the Rizhna Rebbe in the late 19th century. So he was twice accused of organizing a revolution against the Russian government, which is like preposterous to think about. It's so funny. You know, how could anybody take that seriously? You know, here's a group of 1,000 Hasidic men that want to take over Russia. Sure, yeah. You know, without arms, mind you.
Right.
Yeah, so anyway, but that's... Yeah.
I'm sure that was forefront there.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Exactly what we wanted. So, you know, anyway, so, but that did happen in Jewish history. Fortunately, the reason that, again, the Babylonian Jewry went well was we had this self-governing ability. Well, that broke down. You know, any good thing, unfortunately, you know, it was great that it lasted as long as it did. It lasted several hundreds of years. But eventually, there came a society that was not quite so tolerant and willing to have Jews run their own government. After all, what can you do when you have Jews under your government and sit by your rules? Well, you can tax them. And they always did, of course, but you can tax them because they're Jews or because they're whatever else you however want to do it. So that was the beginning of that area. Okay, at that point in time, Jews really went everywhere. Now, they had always been quote-unquote everywhere, but this is the time when they went extensively to Western Europe, talking Spain, the south of France, Northern Africa primarily. Okay, so the Mediterranean basin, if you think of the Mediterranean, like the west of the Mediterranean, both north and south. And you have a map in your mind? All right. So Spain was chock full of Jews. This is we're talking about the year 900, the year 1000. So Spain at that time, and there were Jews in Spain for already 200-300 years, mind you. But large numbers started coming now. Algeria, Tunisia, you know, they developed Morocco, developed sizable Jewish communities. Okay. And this is the age of the Rishonim now. The Rishonim literally means the early ones. It means the early commentaries. And this is the end of the Masorah. Because after the Rishonim, then what anyone else does is trying to figure out what the Rishonim are saying. Everything else is commentary on the Rishonim. With rare exception. Like the Vilna Gaon, for example, would reach back and try to disprove Rishonim from things that he saw elsewhere in the earlier material. Rare. Okay. And the rest of the discussion is going to be really on who these people are and the commentaries on them and why that's important. Okay. One of... it's a question whether he's a Rishon or a Gaon, but one of the... I guess one of the earliest Rishonim is someone named Rabbeinu Chananel. Now, I have to look because he's not on every page. He's on many pages. And you still see him, actually. It's not a standard commentary. And it's not here. See, I could have planned this a little better. Okay, so I don't want to waste your time.
No,
Sometimes you'll see him with a little commentary. Usually it runs throughout the bottom like this. But this is not him. This is Reb Nissen Gaon. Okay. That's another one of the Gaonim. That's a very late Gaon or early Rishon, but he's known as Reb Nissen Gaon or the Ron. Okay? That would be here. Sometimes you see Rabbeinu Chananel also running in a little line here. That is occasionally a commentary that's used on one of the it is one of the earliest commentaries we have on the Talmud. Okay, so oftentimes if it is there, I think she's a little chilly. Oftentimes if it is if it is there,
close the door. I don't know how to make it.
Sorry. if he is there, that's looked at as an early discussion. Oh, good. Right. Now he had a disciple. He either lived in all his life or moved to Fez, which is a city in Morocco. Still is a city in Morocco, Fez, okay? But all of old city. I would love to go there once. I'd like to see that because obviously Jewish history is remarkable there. But he had a disciple whose name was Yitzchak, and since he lived in Fez, he was called Rabbi Yitzchak Alfazi, Isaac of Fez. Okay, this is way before they had last names. Okay? And he was known, therefore, by the acronym, the RIF. Rav Yitzchak Fez. Okay? The RIF had an idea. This is the 11th century now. He had an idea. Okay, he, at that time already, he recognized that the average person would have a very difficult time knowing what to do in any given situation. Think about it. We did not have halacha books then. Okay? There were probably classes in halacha. But if you wanted to know how to find it for yourself, good luck to you. Okay? There was no abridged version, not only, of the Gemara. You'd have to go through not only one Gemara, because as you may be aware, if you want the Gemara about Brachos, it's probably in Brachos. Not for sure. There's lots of, for Kiddush, for example, all the Brachos of Kiddush is in Pesachim usually, for some reason, wind up being there. If you want, if you want to know about Yom Tov, you can have to look at Brachos. You have to look at Pesachim. You have to look at Sukkos. You have to look at Beah. You have to look at several and you have to know all of them because they could be in one place or another place. So if you want to look up something on the middle of a Shabbos afternoon, good luck to you. You know, you have to go through, it wouldn't work, right? So so he had an idea. He said, you know, one of the things that makes the Gemara difficult, and there are many, but at that time, language was not one of them, because even though they had moved, now they're in Fez. If you look at a map, that's a big distance from Fez, Morocco, all the way to Iraq. Okay, it was Arabic land, but it was before, you know, it was after the Arabs took over, so it was Arabic land. However, their language is not Arabic. Their language was, you know, Armenian. So they spoke Ivrit. They always be able to speak Ivrit, of course. Torah is in Hebrew, right? The Tanakh is in Hebrew. But they spoke Aramaic. So that language was not an issue. Reading without vowels is not an issue. Okay, that's just an issue for us. But what was an issue was the Gemara is not straightforward. It's a conversation, right? And there's a couple of things that distract you from learning what is the bottom line. One is that there is ongoing discussion on a question, and you might get to the end way down the line, way far away. And you may have several discussions, and not only they may be tangential discussions from which you're going to get something else, then eventually find its way back to the discussion. So he said, that's one. And two is the stories, which are nice, and we're supposed to learn from the stories, but they're not halakhic stories, right? So he took out all the stories. He took out all the stuff other than what minimally you need to know to find out what the bottom line is. What time do you say Kriya Shema? At this time. Bing. Okay? Rather than a whole discussion of why it said that, how come it said this way, why do we learn night before day, over and over and over again. Okay? So it's, if you will, a very, very condensed Gemara. I'll show you. Okay? So if you go to the back, I could have actually... This is the Rebbein Rasha, that's the Rosh, that's later. But if you go to the back, here's the Rif. The Rif looks like, here it is, looks like Gemara. So when you get back to this, Matkeya, sorry, that is Gemara. These are the other Mishnayos of Zerayim.
Is this all Zerayim that we're looking at?
Which is Brachos, so it'd be Zerayim, right?
Brachos, okay. Which is under Zerayim.
Bingwash, that's the Rosh. Now, where's the Rif? It is here. Okay. I know it's out. I don't study the Rif out there right now.
people can study the Talmud and not study the Rif?
Most of us do. I don't study the Rif. You only study the Rif to see. Usually, if people study the Rif, only to find other commentaries on the Rif. Okay, I'm sorry. You see, if you, it's, there it is. That's the Rif. I told you it looked just like it. Okay? So that would be the Rif. And you can cover this much material in the Rif. That would be about a page and a half of Gemara, or 2 pages of Gemara. Okay?
I'm sorry, that was just too fast for me. Where is the Rif? I thought that was the Gemara. That's the Rif?
It looks like the Rif, right? The Gemara is in front.
The Gemara is in front.
So you go behind, you go past the Gemara, and then you find other commentaries, then soon you have the Rif.
I thought the Gemara was in the middle of every page.
Right. The reason you can identify a Rif is because over here it says Rashi. And it doesn't say Rashi in the Gemara. It never says the Rashi. It says understood. Oh, this one does. Never mind. This one does. And there's the Ron, which is Rabbeinu Nissen. And there is no Ron. There's Tosfos on the Gemara.
Okay.
So that says Rabbeinu Nissen. It's either Rabbeinu Nissen or one of the other main commentators on the other side. Okay. And then there's other commentaries here. Okay. This is actually an unusual Gemara because I can see right now it says a different parish here. This is parish of Rosh, and that's usually not the way it goes. All right, but the point is that the Rif looks just like Gemara, but you can tell from the commentaries on it, and if you look at it, you'll see that it reads much faster. Okay.
So once more for the incredibly slow. Usually there's Tosafos when it's the Gemara in the middle that you're looking at there. Usually it's Tosafos that you'll see here, and it'll say Tosafos up top.
This one does, oddly enough, but the usual one does not.
You're assumed to know that it is? How do you know that it is?
This doesn't say Rashi here. It doesn't say Tosfos there.
Okay, so how do you...
This is Mr. Shas with these comments here.
Right.
And this is here, but there's nothing. You know.
Well, how do you know?
You just know.
That's not fair.
That is not
fair. You'll see the... Sorry, the Ron around it.
It says Rabbeinu. It says Reishnun, Ron.
Okay.
And then sometimes they'll say Rashi, sometimes it doesn't say Rashi on the other side. But that's
fine.
Okay. No, it's by out of Rashi. Okay. So that was his idea. And the goal, again, what's the goal? The goal is to make halacha, Jewish law, a bit more manageable to the average person. Okay? So already you saw by the 11th century, there was a problem of a challenge of, you know, that the leaders recognized. Of how do you teach the world to learn on their own?
Okay.
That was one thought. Now, the Rif had a Talmud whose name is Rabbeinu Yosef Ibn Magash. Yosef Ibn, like Ben, from the city of Gash, or the Rimagash. We have quite a bit on him, usually quoted by others. We have excerpts of him. We know he wrote a lot more than we do have. But he had a student named Maimon, who had a son named Moshe. You probably heard of him. Moshe ben Maimon, or the Rambam. The Rambam wrote about the Rimagash as his teacher, and it was not his teacher, because the age difference would make it virtually impossible. The Rimagash was in his mid-90s or early 90s when the Rambam was a child. So maybe that he met him once. But his father was the main Talmud of the Rimagash. And he probably, what meant is that everything the Rimagash was, his father took. You know, it's like he absorbed everything. But he held the Rimagash was his teacher. Okay? We will see that the Rif and the Rambam do not hold the same way. So the Masorah between them is a little different. But we're led to believe that the Masorah between the Rimagash and the Rambam are probably almost identical. Now, he had a different idea. He dealt with the same problem. But he had a different way of handling it altogether. And that is, see, with the Rif, it's easier. But he still has the same problem, because he has some halachas here, some here, some here, some here. Mm-hmm. There was no organized way to do it. So he thought, wouldn't it be more logical to organize everything? Mm-hmm. So that a Jew can wake up and he says, if I want to know about, you know, all the laws of Avodah Zarah, they're all in one place. If I want to know about the laws of Shabbos, it's all in one place.
Right.
Organized by topic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's the first time that was done. So the Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah, which is his classic work. He wrote many, many pieces. He wrote and it's still studied today, the whole Perush on Mishnayos, the whole explanation of the Mishnayos, which is still, you know, he wrote a lot of things. But the Mishnah Torah was his magnus opus. Is that how you say it? Right? It took him like 20, 30 years to write. Everything else he wrote when he was a kid. 20. You know, this actually took a long, long time. And it is authoritative to this day, and to the extent that there are things, for example, Hilchos Tshuva, the Halachos of Tshuva, is still studied in Yeshiva today. If you want to know about the steps to do Tshuva, Rambam is text material today. Okay? So there are certain things in there that are still like that. The Rambam wrote about everything, not just Halachos that are pertinent today, but even, you know, he wrote about Mashiach coming. Chabad is big on studying Rambam, and the Hilchos Malachim, which is, you know, laws of kings. So the last perek in that, the last chapter of that volume is about when Mashiach comes, because he's Melech HaMashiach, right? So they study that with a fine tooth comb. That's a major learning point. He has a lot, all the halachas of the agricultural laws in Eretz Israel, all the halachas of Tara and Tuma, all the halachas of the Kodshim, the sacrifices that are brought. So later, as we'll talk about, others that actually started enumerating and organizing halacha, they said, you know what, this even that's too complicated. We're just going to make it for the today's Jew. Today's Jew doesn't have to know about korbanos. He's not going to bring a korban. Okay? Hopefully he will. But then you go to the Rambam and find it there. But, you know, we have a bigger problem. He doesn't know how to keep Shabbos, you know? So let us deal with that. All right? So that was the Rambam. That was called, sometimes you'll hear it called, it's called the Mishnah Torah, I think I mentioned, but it's also called the Yad Chazaka. That's a play on words, the hand of strength, right? But Yad is Gematria 14, and he had 14 volumes. And that was intentional. It wasn't a coincidence that it was like that. It was a play with words there. So you hear it called the Yad. Sometimes people refer to it as the Yad. Or people just call it the Rambam. When people say, the Rambam said, that's what they mean. Or you'll find this in the Rambam, that's what they mean. Okay? In the Gemara, okay. So here. Have you learned this at all? Gemara, have you learned Gemara with you?
A little bit. I was just thinking that.
Pardon me?
I think this was...
That's the Rambam, right?
Yeah.
That's right. That's the English. But that's the Rambam, right. So here's the Gemara once again. Here's Rashi on the inside of the page. Here's Tosfos, right? That's the basic structure of the Gemara. We're going to get to Rashi and Tosfos in just a minute. But over here is something called Ein Mitz Mishpat Ner Tam. Ner, what is that? I can't read upside down. Ner Mitzvah. Okay? This is it's not a commentary exactly, but someone came along and said, you know, I have an idea. Why don't we make a little notation of every place there's a halachic reference, every point. Okay? And it's like footnoting. Mm-hmm. And he put a little olive base gimel throughout here. Here's one there. Okay? So, and then you look up here, and you'll have, I think it's three sources usually of where you can find the halacha. The first is just. The first, no, I'm sorry, the second one is the just. The first and the third are generally what we look up. The first is Rambam. Okay, so it'll tell you where in the Rambam you can find this halacha.
Oh, cool.
Where in the 14 books.
Right. By which book, which chapter, and which halacha. Chapters of verse, halacha. Okay? And then from there, you can conquer the world, right? From there, you got everything, right? Okay. The second one is called the Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos. It's like it just enumerates the mitzvahs and explains a little bit about it. We're not going to talk about that one. The third is the Tur Shulchan Aruch, which we will talk about in just a moment. Okay? So that's all here. Okay? It's these little notes here. Now, there's a fair number here, like six or seven here. There are, there's quite a few here. There's like 10, 12. There's very few here. There's more here. Okay, so every page, many pages have some halachic reference point. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're the same one, okay? Because there's discussions going back and forth, right? Here, they're all there.
Does it list all the cross references?
What? Please?
I'll just go over that again slowly, about the letters and what they refer to.
Okay, I can't read upside down very well, so let me try to read it to you, okay? So here is First, you see over here, Lamed Hey. Okay. That is a reference that began at the beginning.
Okay.
That continues. Here's Lamed Dalet, here's Lamed Gimel, here's Lamed Beis. Okay, that means 35,
okay.
Right? And then, the next letter is the reference on this page, because on the page it'll only be called Aleph. So if you look...
Okay, in other words, Aleph corresponds to the first one cited.
On the page, right.
It only means, even though it's called Lamed Dalet, it's really the first one
right.
cited, and that means Aleph. Okay,
okay, so here's right. the base, for example.
See, that would be the base?
That would be this base, the second one here, base.
This one,
and
right?
And then you have this
okay,
thing
right.
called Mem Yud Yud
okay.
Dash.
Oh, there it is. Right? Oh, duh. There's a little Aleph and a little base. Okay.
So you see next to the base, it says Mem Yud Yud
right.
Dash, right? That's Maimonides.
Okay. Maimonides.
This next thing is Shin Mem, which means Sham, which means see above the last referenced book that I told you.
Okay.
Malacha, Halacha, Dalid.
Okay.
So that's the same parak, the same chapter we talked about,
mm-hmm.
but this time it's chapter 4.
Okay.
So, for example, here's Maimonides, Perek Nun, Mehilchos Kriyashma, Halacha Yud Gimel Yud Dalid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's the Rambam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over here, the next one, it says Smag, which is the Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos. Smag.
Okay.
We're not going to talk about that. But okay. it's one of several enumerators of mitzvah from 1 to 613.
Okay.
So it says asin, which is a positive commandment, ase,
okay.
yud ches.
Okay.
Okay. That one I've never needed to look up because other. But tur, shulchan aruch.
Okay.
That's the tur shulchan aruch. Okay. Which we'll talk about in a moment. Aruch Chaim, which we'll talk about in a moment. Simon, which is chapter, kind of like section, I guess. Mm-hmm. Samech dalid, sif base, gimel and dalid. So if you go to that section in Shulchan Aruch, you'll see that it's discussed in those three areas. Mm-hmm. Beis, Gimel, Dalet.
Okay.
Okay? That's all that means.
Fine. So they're discussed in the sources which are later and more topically organized things, where to find them there.
Right.
Okay, fine.
The Gemara is not at all organized.
Okay.
At all. It is like all over the map, right? So if you learn a little bit of Gemara, the first thing you'll see is, like, where are you going? Well, it's very frustrating to learn if you don't know. If you haven't learned Gemara like that. So that's why it's a whole unique type of learning that you've never seen before, and so on.
You just got kind of crazy when you started trying to learn.
Yeah, everything is unusual and different, and the structure is different. Yeah. So you can see where this is going, because if the leaders like the Rif and the Rambam are saying, you know, the people today, they don't know halacha, and they can't even look it up.
Uh-huh.
They don't know where to look. How do you look it up, right?
Right.
So the Rambam really was the first place you actually could look it up. Actually, you could look it up. If you had a question, you can go to the Rambam and look it up. Okay? And one of the main challenges of the Rambam was he never cited references. But he would bring where it is in Torah, or Tanakh, but he wouldn't bring where it is in the Gemara. Why he did that is a question, is a debate. Some say he wanted you to go back and learn it anyway. He didn't want you to just go back, you know, people who had more time on their hands really should study all of the Gemara. Some say that he didn't want the opposite. He didn't want you to bother with going back. This is all you really needed to know. And there's a whole discussion back and forth. So we're going to leave the controversies aside, because there's plenty to know about the controversies. Okay. That was going on in Spain, south of Spain, Morocco, at the two sides of the Gibraltar, right? Meanwhile, up in northern and the middle of Europe, there was an important figure in Jewish history by the name of Rabbeinu Gershon. Rabbeinu Gershon was a Rishon. We talked about him already when we talked about Takanas. He made the famous Takanas of Rabbeinu Gershon, which we're not going to talk any more about. He was in the 10th century, so he was an early Rishon. He had a student whose name was Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Yakar, of whom we would know nothing about, except that he had a Talmud by the name of Rashi, who wrote about him. Okay, Rashi we know plenty about. One of the first things you need to know about Rashi, because we have this idea of him living luxuriously in the library, smoking his pipe, writing all day long. He lived in the middle of the Crusades. The first Crusade was right in the middle of his life. And there was another one that came by a little later on. These were not tranquil times, okay? In fact, if you can get this book, this is hard to get because it's out of print, unfortunately, but this is a great book. It's called the Rishonim, and there's many things that are good about it, but the best thing about it is in the beginning it gives you a real handle on what the Rishonim lived through by section. There's the Middle East, there's Babylonia, there's France, there's Spain, you know, and so on and so forth. And, you know, but then it goes through every single Rishon, big and small.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I shouldn't say that. There's no small, but, you know, bigger and bigger, I guess, right? You'd say, by name, what they wrote, who they were, who their teachers were, when they live, remarkable. It's very, very good. Even if you don't like biographies, you know, it's still very good. But it's unfortunately out of print, like I said, and it's hard to get. If you can, I highly remember. I didn't recommend you get lots of books, right? This is the one. This is one of the ones that I would recommend. All right. So, but you get a handle on what they lived through. It wasn't like we envisioned. The Rashi had no sons. He had three daughters, all of whom were Talmid Chacham. We know that they were very learned women. And they had sons. And they had great sons. Among Rashi's grandchildren are Rabbeinu Tam, who was actually named Yaakov, but because Yaakov Avinu was called Ish Tam, we learned from Toldos a couple of weeks ago, so everyone calls him Rabbeinu Tam. The Rashbam, Rabbeinu Shimon ben Meir, the Rashbam, the Rivan, R-I-V-A-N, I forgot exactly, but those are all three of his several grandchildren, and they were all Rishonim, and they comprise the beginnings of the main part, or the beginnings of what's called the Tosafos. The Tosafos literally means those that add, to be Mosif, to add is means to add something. Baal Tosif is you shouldn't add to the Torah. So it's an Avera to add mitzvahs to the Torah. Okay? To add to the mitzvahs. So the Tosafos means those that add. So what they're adding is they're adding to Rashi, really. They're adding to the main front. And what it's interesting, what Rashi was remarkable at being concise, at being like getting right to the point on the word, and in fact, he would only discuss something, this is both in Torah, in Tanakh, and in the Gemara, he would only bring a comment down if he had something to say, or if he thought you might have something to ask. Like, you'd be puzzled by this. In fact, one of the things I've learned is, sometimes I don't understand why there's a Rashi. I don't understand what he's adding, and I don't understand what the question is. It seems so clear. So it must be, A, Rashi is way off the mark, which is highly unlikely. B, I don't get something. I'm missing something. And that's probably what it is, because the alternative is impossible. Right? So, and that's one way to learn. That's one thing to learn from Rashi. Is if he's bringing something, that means he either had a question or he anticipates that one of his students would have a question. Okay? And he answers it in like one or two words sometimes. You know, just like remarkably brief. That's all you need, really. Now,
but his grandchildren had a comment on his comments anyway.
His Tosafot, well, because sometimes it's not so clear why Rashi felt this way. Because, like, Rashi just wants to answer questions. Tosafot is like looking for problems, you know? They come on, something that's interesting, it drives me wild. People refer to Tosafot as a person, as a single person. He says this. What did he? Dozens of people. But there's many, many people, and they're usually not named. Usually, the only like exceptions is there's a few exceptions, but Rabbeinu Tam is an exception. Frequently, they'll cite him by name. The Ri Hazakein, Rabbeinu Yitzhak, the elder, is an exception. But there's several Tosfos that are actually mentioned occasionally and unusually. Generally, it's just, you know, like as if one person's writing. That's how it did. They didn't say we took a census and what we came up with was this. In fact, I don't even know if it's known how this was all redacted, because it was done over generations. So I don't even know if it's known how it happened. You know, one person added here, another person added here, and then they said no. I don't know how exactly. I'm not sure if people know. I've never heard it discussed. but it'll always say, you might think that this would be the case, however, and this is where they would say, look over here at other Gemaras. Always would like compare this to other Gemaras. Or I would say, for example, in the beginning of Kedushin, right? It says, Aisha Niknes Beshlasha Drachim, right? So a woman is married in three ways. So And the, by the way, in the first Tosfos, someone says, is why does it say nikne? He says, why does it say it in a passive form? Why does it say a man marries? You know, put it in the and it contrasts that with, I forgot where else, but somewhere else. Oh, in properties, in purchases of properties, it says it in the, it doesn't say property is purchased in three ways. It says, you know, a person can purchase property in three, you know, so why is it, and right away it gets into the differences between there, and the whole page goes on about why that. So, again, looking for problems, things that you wouldn't even ask otherwise. And it certainly doesn't answer the question. Rashi's not interested in that. He just wants to make sure you understand the Gemara.
So when you're studying the Gemara, you're reading a little bit of the Gemara, you're stopping, and then you're looking, glancing over to the Rashi.
Mm-hmm.
Do you then go over to Tosfos?
Oh, great question. How do you learn Gemara? Learning Gemara the way your teacher teaches you Gemara. Now, it really depends on whatever level. The first time you start going over Gemara, then the way it's done is someone tells you and knows the Rashi already and then explains it according to the Rashi. He doesn't pause and say, take a look at this Rashi. And he never brings the Tosfos because that's a higher level already. Okay? By the time, for example, a young man is in 8th grade, 7th or 8th grade, usually 8th grade, they're ready for Tosfos. Okay, and the teacher knows which of the juicy Tosfos, which one is, because sometimes Tosfos is just mind-boggling, and it's minutia, and, you know, it's always important because it's Torah, but it's a point that most of us would find, like, why do I need to know this kind of thing, right? Whereas others are actually quite interesting, and have a tremendous difference of halacha. Usually when Ashkenaz Paskin, it's based on Tosfos. So therefore, it's worthwhile knowing how they, you know, how they decipher this, because they generally have very, very good points.
So is Tosos a little more definitive discussion on Rashi? It's just if he's so clear, why?
It's not all clear. Rashi's very clear. Is that what you meant?
Rashi's very clear.
Rashi's very, very clear. Right.
But still, it's necessary for Tosos to make comments on Rashi's interpretation of Gemara.
Sometimes it's just on Gemara itself. Like, for example, the one I decided.
So it does comment sometimes directly on Gemara.
The one I cited has nothing to do with Rashi, because Rashi, you know, Aisha Niknes, why does the Gemara say that? Rashi has no comment there. There's nothing. There is no Rashi on that, because how do you misunderstand that? You know, this happens in three ways. Okay, fine. Next, you know, and you may want to know about what the three ways are. There, Rashi has a comment on it, and the Tosfos will immediately jump on says, like, this is an unusual way to word things. And then when it's numbered, Tosfos always gets into these, like, it's numbered. Why is it number 1, 2, 3? It should be this one first, and why is it not, you know, like that? And these are not Rashi's problems. Rashi doesn't care about that. He just wants to make sure you understand the Gemara.
This is what it is.
This is what the Gemara is saying, period. End of discussion.
Not trying to reinvent, just
right.
Clear.
Yeah. Later you can have problems like, you know, this doesn't go with this, very nice, but we're just trying to get through the page here. Okay? Yeah, that's Rashi's your Rebbe. Like, rest your, like, you know, here, let them hold your hand and let them understand what each word means, and, you know, and then how you go on. Now, Rashi, of course, did not speak English, so when Rashi says, this is an unusual word, this is what it means, you go, that doesn't help me at all. Because it'll bring old French, you know? I don't know that language yet, you know? So there's a dictionary, by the way, of, you know, laws to Hebrew, and, you know, someone will invent a laws English one of these days. It'll be nice. The art school, that's one of the major projects, I guess, down the line. That is Rashi and Tosfos. It's very important that we understand this.
So it was later when Afshi...
Rashi?
Afshi commented... When he made comments on the Gemara, I mean, I'm not clear how he fits in.
Rashi or?
Al-Fazi?
Rabbein Al-Fazi? Riff? The Riff was, remember, in a different geographical area, and he actually was about the same time as Rashi. Okay?
Both in the 11th century.
Yeah. Right? The Rashi was 11th century. Tosfos was, you know, over the next couple hundred years, so that was a couple of hundred.
You said Rashi was the 10th century.
I did? Yeah, no, Brenna Gershon was 10th century. Rashi was about the student of a student.
Oh, okay.
So Rashi was 11th century. 1040 to 1105. I didn't memorize that.
1040.
To 1105. Okay. Meanwhile, in Germany, okay, so a little bit east, there was another Rishon who did not write much. He spent the last years of his life in prison, unfortunately. And he died in prison. It was in the Maharam in Rothenburg. The Maharam, the last letter Mem is his name, Meir. But whenever you hear the Maha something, like Maharal, Maharsham, okay, that stands, that's an acronym again, and it means Morenu, Rav, so-and-so. Maha, Morenu, Harav, right? So in this case, the last letter is a Mem, so it's Meir. His name is Meir. So Rabbeinu Meir, and who lived in Rottenburg. That sounds German, and it is. Okay? He was very important. And he had Talmud by the name of Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel, who was born in 1250. So he lived in the 13th and 14th century. So we can see that we're moving along now. He certainly knew of Rashi, and he knew of his grandchildren. And he, remember, I talked about with the Rif and the Rambam, I talked about organizing and reorganizing. I didn't say a thing about organizing and reorganizing with Rashi and Tosfos. They didn't organize. They came to comment. That's a different thing altogether, right? So the Rabbeinu Asher, whose acronym is the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher. Okay, so you hear the name the Rosh. That's who it is. He had a different idea. He did something which is very similar to the Rif, but it's harder to find because it doesn't look like this. It just looks like blank pages. It looks like this, but it's kind enough. It says, Asher, that's it. Look at that. Rabbeinu Asher. See Asher? Okay, so that's the Rosh. Look at that. This time I flip right to it. Okay? And it goes by which parak you're in. So it's harder to find. But this is again a running discussion of the Gemara. But it's there's no additional commentary on it. It's just like the Rif, and all it is like it'll have a couple lines, and then it'll go on to the next thing, which may be two pages later. Okay. So because I was trying to do is just abbreviate to crunch it down so that people he wanted to do that later. But the Rif was Sfardi, right? So this is a very different Masura. So sometimes the halachas are different in the Rosh than in the Rif, which is going to be very important in a few minutes. So then the
does his comment appear right after in the same?
They usually the Rif, yeah, the Rif is like
right
here.
You're studying, you would follow successively.
I don't know if anybody just has like a limud, a study session on. Look, today we're going to study the Rosh. That's not done that way. Usually, what is done is like the people who give it over will know that there's a very important Rosh because how we wind up understanding something will come from here. So he'll be learning. They'll be learning Gemara, and then they'll say, "Let's now look at the Rosh on page this, this, and this. I've made an arrow here for you. On the seventh line. Let's read together." That's usually how it's taught. It's exceptionally rare. I've never heard of. Well, I'm sure someplace. the people are descendants of the Rosh, so maybe they want to learn. Exactly every line that he said, but it's very rare.
You can learn through Gemara and sort of mostly just learn the Rashi and Tosafos, or maybe just like the Rashi and Tosafos, and not have people laugh at you that you haven't learned anything else. Like you can look somebody in the eye and say you know the Gemara and you've only learned. No, seriously.
It depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking about Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I laugh at you, of course. Every time you're talking about the Gedolei Dor, that's understood. That by heart, of course, everyone knows that. But if you talk to any of the people in this city, then you're quite something. If you've gone through all the Gemara with Rashi and Tosfos, that's exceptional.
Okay, so that's a standard way of approaching learning the Tosfos.
I think it's unusual that someone has gone through every Tosfos. Usually, what people do is they'll go through selected Tosfos.
Oh, so even Tosafos is not. Oh, you said that it's not always learned in full in each Gemara.
Not right.
Okay, fine then.
Okay.
Okay. Gotcha.
How many books of Gemara are there?
Oh, it's huge. So if you do one page a day, a page is a folio, I should say. So this would be a page, one, two. You can do two pages a day, right? It would take 7.5 years to get through it. So you can do the math, but it's a long time. That's 22,000 pages, I guess, something like that.
Wow.
And so how many of these?
It depends on how you license, cut, and paste
different,
it.
Oh, different.
Yeah, this
different
is one tractate. This is one tractate. Some have three tractates.
In one book? Yeah.
Okay, because they're short. And then the art scroll, of course, is much bigger because since it's English and Hebrew and commentary, right, so there's more pages, right? So all that from here to bottom, I think that's one per, I don't think they have multiple copies here, do they? I don't know.
So how do you know, like, if you want to find something on on marriage law. How would you know which book to go to?
You do the opposite of this. Remember I told you? You're going to find the halacha? You go to where the halacha is.
Well,
I'll tell you in a second. Okay, almost there. And then there's a reverse way to do it. You know, so you go from there, and you go, I wonder where it is in the Gemara. Then you can go back to the Gemara and find out inside. But the Gemara is no way to find what Jewish law is about. Because
so you
it's
mean
too
the table of contents is really this?
It's a very rough index, more than a table of contents.
And that, until you read that, then it would refer you to
back to here. Right? Okay.
It's the other way around.
Yeah. So, well, which is why people write books now, on, laws of marriage, right? So what they do is they try to take all the various parts of this, put it together, and then they have what's called haskamas, where they go to big rabbis who write, letters of approbation. Yes, I know this guy. He's very authoritative. I've looked at this book. It's great. It's needed. It's valuable. Yada, 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 right? So it's all, and then therefore you can read it. Now you have the books of the laws of marriage. And that's how these books come about. And that's why they're popular, because who's going to read through Sefer Kedushin? The Sefer Kedushin, it takes a long time to go through it. And it doesn't answer your questions anyway. Right? Because we're not quite finished, all right? So we have now, what we talked about is we talked about three trains of Masorah, right? The Rif and the Rambam on one side, right? We had Rashi Tosfos, right? And then we had Rabbeinu Gershon Rashi Tosfos. And then we had the Maharam Rothenberg, and his student, the Rush. The Rush's son is, what's his name? Rabbeinu Yechiel. No, Asher ben Yechiel is Yechiel. Right, Yaakov. So Rabbeinu Yaakov, who is the son of Asher, but he doesn't go by that. He's called Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Baal Haturim, because he had yet another idea. He said that the Rambam was on the mark, as far as organizing the material, but 14 is still too much, and the average Jew doesn't need to know about today, about karbanos, about sacrifices, about temple law, about purity, and that's not relevant today. Everyone has this, we all have a din of tumas mace, right, because we probably have some kind of contact directly or indirectly with someone, a corpse, not even carried it, but there's easy ways to do that, so therefore we probably have that. So it does, and we can't bring a red heifer, so we can't get rid of it. So, well, let's just focus on the laws that are active to this day. And he says, let's break it up into four parts. So we had four chapters, four parts. He called them Turim. That's why it's called the Baal HaTurim. Okay? Each one is called a Tur, which I think is Aramaic for section. Okay? And they are Orach Chaim, which literally means the ways of life. We'll talk about what each one means in just a moment, and we're not going to finish. This is still on this week. No wonder we only had this today. All right.
I'm sorry.
It's a lot. No, you're not sorry. It's like it's fascinating stuff. Okay. Right. We're not done. Let me just finish the four, and then I'll explain what they are, and then we'll open for questions again. Yoredeya. And I don't know what that means.
Yoredeya?
Yeah, seeing and understanding. I don't know, but I'll explain what they mean. Literally, I don't exactly know what Yoredeya means. Fear of knowledge, I don't know, fear and knowledge perhaps.
So like more, like being more halacha?
Oh, more halacha, learning halacha.
I
but
don't
it's,
know. I don't know.
Okay.
Even answering.
Choshen Mishpat. Mishpat, remember, are laws between man and man. Interhuman laws. And Choshen Mishpat is what the Kohen used to wear on his chest where the Urim Tumim would rest. So that was a kind of a play on words there. And the final one was Evan Ha'ezer, which I don't know what that means either. But I'll tell you what the topics are. These are by topic. Okay? Let's go in reverse order because that's the easiest way to do it. Okay? Evan Ha'ezer is all marriage laws. Anything to do with marriage, getting married, getting divorced, anything, what a husband's responsibility are, what a wife's responsibilities are, it's all in there. So that answers part of your question, right? So now, if you go to Evan Ha'ezer, and you happen to know where it is in there, and it's not that hard to find, because it's by topic now. Each one of these is by topic, so you'll open it up. Bottom here. Yes? Meh. Meh. Is it locked? It's locked.
Hi.
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 Oh. Hi.
Are you done?
No, why? You need people from Mari? I got from Mari.
Okay, we're there.
You got it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, good. Okay. In a moment, I'll actually take you through Ebenezer and all that different places, but or at least a sample of that book, Turim. This is it called Arba Turim. See, Arba Turim. Okay, and so let me crack it open in just a moment.
That would be one book.
No, because this is Or HaChaim Aleph. So usually, Or HaChaim is probably the biggest. As far as most material is in there, so usually that's split up into two. Yoredeiah is the next biggest, and that's probably split up into two. And Choshen Mishpat's one, and Ebenezer is one. So there's four, but there's usually six books because of that.
Okay.
Usually. And I'm sure there's some with more commentary, which are bigger. So
we would refer to these books today because they're more what's happening in our lives that we would deal with.
Almost. They're almost there. Okay? Almost there. Okay? Keep up. We're almost done for today. Okay. We're almost done with today. I think if you get all this, you're doing great. Okay. And I'm skipping a lot of stuff, but these are the key stuff to know. Choshen Mishpat is what you would assume. It's all dinim, all laws between people, from returning lost objects to what you do in court. To swearing in court, when you need to take an oath, when you don't take an oath, to, all monetary laws. You can imagine. Huge amount of stuff, right? And people generally study this are the ones who are going to go to be judges. Okay? Most people don't study this regularly. They get a shear in it. They get a look at it. Yeah? All the laws of chesed are in here, by the way, in Choshen Mishpat. Visiting sick. Escorting a dead, I think, is in here, but there's some of those laws that are actually in Yoredeiah. Yoredeiah is Isser and Heter. What is permissible, what is forbidden. Clear, cut, chok. So, Kashrus is in there, for example. By the way, Nida is in, I think, as Ebenezer. Okay? So, in case you're wondering, then that would be under that. What else is in your idea? Oh my goodness.
But some of these would have some...
All laws regarding food is certainly in there.
Some of these would have some crossover, like marriage would have be faithful, not to have any relations with anybody else, but then permissible and forbidden might be in there as well.
They try to make it as clear as possible, because that's the whole goal. The goal is you go to the right book.
Right.
Yeah, rabbis, to get smicha, you have to know a fair amount of your idea. Kashrus is really big in that. Tevilah, dunking dishes, kashrus, all that's part of kashrus too, but that's a whole different aspect of it. What requires tevilah, what doesn't require tevilah. Okay, and Or HaChaim is that which we study most of the time. It's all holidays, all Shabbos, blessings, gosh, it's most of the stuff that we study most of the time. Okay? So let's look at it a little bit. And we're not going to quite, and we're almost finished. This is the first sap chapter. So if you open it up,
this is which book?
This is Or HaChaim. Or HaChaim. It's the first one.
Okay.
It's Chelek Rishon, which means the first section, which is two books. There is no official two section, but since it's too big, almost all publishers put this as two books. And this is Varsha, which is where it's published, Warsaw. Okay. All right, and let's forget this for the time being. I'll point it out in just a moment. And here's some introductory comments. Here's more introduction, and then it begins here, I think. Halachos Hanhagas Adam Baboker. So it begins at the course of the day. When you wake up, this is what you have to do. First thing you have to do when you wake up in the morning. And it goes on, It goes like the next section is Halachos Tzitzis. And then it's over here, it's Halachos Tefillin. And then it's Halachos Tefillah. Mm-hmm. And then it says, we skip Kriya Shema. Okay? And this is a Kriya Sefer Torah. Okay?
It looks like the Gemara. too.
Guess why? Because Jews by this time were already used to reading Gemara with Rashi and Tosfos already, okay? So therefore they said, how about this? Now that's not how it was written. It was just written this section. But like every other book, commentaries came along, okay? This is the Bais Chadash. This is the Drisha and the Prisha, which were written by the same person, by the way. But the one I wanted to point out was this one. This is the Bais Yosef. Okay? Bais Yosef is the most authoritative commentary on the Tur. And you know the author. The Bais Yosef was Rabbi Yosef Karo. Joseph Karo.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And, pardon me?
Spot, right?
Yeah, well, not from Sfat, but he went to Sfat. Yeah, he went from Spain. He went the expulsion. He went through that. He lived in Turkey for a while, and then he finally wound up in Sfat. Right. So he wrote this, and this is a running commentary on the entire tour. Okay, not only is it a commentary, but he would often bring other Rishonim. He would collect Rishonim. He wasn't the only one that did that. There are people who actually did it more effectively. There's something called the Shita Mikubethis, which your husband probably learned, which is a collection of Rishonim. And it's written by Bezalel Ashkenaz, I think his name was. And he literally, that's what he did. He went throughout Europe, and south and north, and he didn't want them to disappear. So he actually wanted to make sure he got as many as he possibly could find. But this is, in minor version, a smaller version, very similar. But relative to whatever is on this page. So he would say, this is what it means, and so-and-so holds this way, so-and-so holds that way. So, you know, so it's very wordy. Okay. After he finished this, Yosef Karo lived... Okay, so where are we? Let's go back and where are we in history? So the Baal HaTurim lived in the 14th century, mostly. Okay. Again, we're talking Germany. Okay. The Yosef Karo lived in the 16th century. Yosef Karo was not a Rishon. So this is a little bit of tomorrow, a middle of next week rather. Okay. He did something, so he commented on this. That's what the commentaries on Tur are all Acharonim, latter commentaries. And we're going to differentiate next week. We'll talk about what's the difference between a Rishon and an Acharon. But I kind of mentioned it already, if you're paying attention. You've got to review your notes. Yosef Karos, again, in his wisdom, said, you know what, this is great. It's a great structure, but the problem is it's one man's opinion. It's a great man's opinion. Okay? So he took the tour, and he said, I'm going to keep the same structure, but I'm going to bring all these other opinions, and I'm going to use who I hold are the three main pillars of Mesorah. The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh, who is this person's father.
Okay,
remember, the person who wrote this is the Yaakov Baal HaTurim. His father was Rabbeinu Yosef ben Asher. No, Yitzhak ben Yechiel ben Asher. Asher ben Yechiel. Got it. It's Rosh, the Rosh. Asher ben Yechiel, I'm sorry. So the Rosh. That was his father. That was the Baal HaTurim's father. Okay? So he took those three, as well as others, but whenever there was uncertainty of what he felt was the halacha, he took two out of the three. Best two out of three wins. That became what's called the Shulchan Aruch.
Okay?
So here is the Shulchan Aruch. And this became, for reasons we'll discuss next week, the authoritative halachic text for all Jews. It is, so, you see how little there is, but here's the Shulchan Aruch. There are so many, you can see, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 commentaries on one page. Okay, so you get lost in it. Your mouth is open.
He's consolidated all of the different commentaries into one book.
That's right. So this is abridged, really, really abridged. Okay, you can actually get through the entire Shulchan Aruch, you know, not in one day, but you can get through it because it's that brief, you know, and you get a handle on Jewish law. You'd have lots of questions,
And you should anyway. You read this, and without any commentaries, you'd be flying by. This is that, the next thing. But what I wanted to point out today is this did not come out of nothing. You understand that?
No, you this, needed all of that.
Yeah, he didn't just like appear one day in the middle of the 16th century. You know, I know what the halakha should be. You know, so you understand how it went from step by step by step. There were commentaries on the Gemara, right? There were redactors of the Gemara saying this is too much. People are not going to be able to sit down and learn what to do. Right? And between those two emphases and the lots of writers, and I'm skipping many, but I wanted to point out the main ones so that you'd know the names. The Rosh, the Rif, the Rambam, the Rosh's son, Yaakov Balaturim. Okay, and then that's the end of the Rishonim that we need to really cover. It's Rashi and Tosfos on the Gemara itself. And then, and for example, he'll frequently cite in the Beis Yosef, he'll frequently cite Tosfos. Frequently. Okay, because he recognized that's an important Rishon, he needs to know. Okay, so, but he won't do it here because he's not here, he just wants to give you the information. And again, if you just open this up and you didn't come to this, you didn't know, it would seem to you that, you know, where is he getting this from? That's where he's getting it from. Okay? And that's really important to understand. Otherwise, it'll seem so arbitrary.
So is the Gemara in the middle there on this
one? No, this is him. This is the Beis Yosef's abridged version, which is called the Shulchan Aruch, which means a set table.
Okay. So I understand the commentaries, but where's the actual basis law? What are they commenting?
What are the commentaries they're saying on?
No. Oh. Yeah, what are they saying on?
They're usually arguing. They're usually saying, how can they say this? You know, it's
but what's the root? I mean, in the Gemara, it's the one paragraph, and then Rashi says something, and Tosfos says
right.
something.
What's the root
where
here?
Is
this,
the root?
This middle section.
Okay, so it is the middle section.
The middle section is the Shulchan Aruch. This is the Shulchan Aruch. All this...
But that's the actual Gemara that we're discussing.
There's no Gemara here. Okay? Again, this is the order is kept with the Balaturim. The order is, what do you do when you first wake up? Okay. What are the halachas of tzitzis? What are the halachas of tefillin? What are the, you know, what are the halachas of the early morning blessings? What are the halachas of Kriya Shema? Everything.
Okay.
When can you say?
Right.
How can you say? What do you have to think about when you say? Right? Thing like it goes to the order of the day, and then it finally finishes. And then the halachas of Shabbos, and it's also in order. By the halachas of Shabbos always begin with how do you prepare for Shabbos? What do you have to do to prepare for Shabbos? And when can you prepare for Shabbos? And then finally, when do you light candles? Right? Who can light candles? Who has to light candles? What if the husband and wife are separate? You know, there's like there's all these various and sundry it goes through, and it goes and then the kiddush, right? It goes through the order of Shabbos. And then when Shabbos is done, then you have all the halachas of Shabbos. One bum 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 bum, in order of malacha, and then it talks about after that. Then it talks about the holidays, general laws about Yom Tov, and then specific Yom Tov. So and it goes in order so that it's organized. Where did it come from? Again, the Gemara is very difficult. It comes from here, and it came from here, and it came from that book, and it came from that book, and it came from right. But they all came from someplace. And if you want to know where, it'll tell you. It does little footnotes. Not so well on the Shulchan Aruch. But in some of the additional later commentaries, one of the greatest places, if you ever like the Mishnah Berurah, we'll talk about the Mishnah Berurah, is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, but only the Orach Chaim section. Okay? And that's what we learned today. That is still authority. That's right, written by the Chafetz Chaim, who passed away in 1933. So that's like very modern stuff in Jewish history.
Is that the last of the modern commentaries?
Oh, no. That still goes on to today. For a number of reasons, but mostly because technology changes, things change, issues change. So you have to apply the same principles to modern examples. The Chafetz Chaim was alive. I don't think there were elevators then. Okay, so people have to figure out whether you can use an elevator on Shabbos. Yeah, so they have to talk to physicists and, you know, hydraulics experts, you know, who could tell them what exactly happens. You know, how does it lift? And what do you know? Not in technical terms, but what really is going on? So, you know, because that wasn't addressed before. Electricity wasn't addressed before. Telephones weren't addressed before. So all this stuff, you know, microwave ovens are not regular ovens. They're not convection ovens. So therefore, the halachas of ovens with regards to kashrus are entirely different. What has to be double covered? How do you kosher an oven? That's not the same with a microwave oven. And there wasn't no microwave oven until, what, 1980? I don't know. Something like that. Whatever it was, 1970, whatever it was, right? So everybody, whenever there's new technology or a new insight or in vitro fertilization, is that permissible? You know, you name it. in health and kitchen aid and going to the rock. You know, there was had to be addressed if you're from Jew. This came up with the Israeli astronaut. He actually asked, even though he wasn't religious.
What about davening?
Yeah, davening. How do you daven? It's absurd. What do you? You know, it's not day or night up there, right? Yeah. Like what do you do?
The earth, like, 1,800 times a day.
Yeah, so that has to be addressed somehow, you know. International dateline, that's their international dateline, the secular one, has nothing to do with Jewish law. So we have a different one. And so when you travel across international dateline, do you have to repeat everything again? Or, you know, how does that work? So those are not relevant until the situation really comes up, and then it becomes a question. And then the leaders go back to this, and find out what, you know, there's actually, believe it or not, the source material for all this stuff.
So if a person's starting out, where do they start to learn?
Not on your own, that's the answer.
Right. what book do you start with?
Right, so, that's a whole, I'm not a rabbi. That's a whole discussion.
Depending on your level.
Depending on the person, his enthusiasm, his desire, his readiness, his intelligence level. And it's also a different street. There's if you go to, there's different Kiruv organizations. Right, it's not just Eishet Torah in the world. There are other organizations, or Sameach is a big one. There is Machon Shlomo is a difference for men. Those are for men. But they both, I don't know Machon Shlomo is a female version. I don't think they do. But they, but our Sameach certainly does.
My son-in-law works there.
Edward Sameach.
The one in Muncie.
Wow, that's, you know. That's
I just said Rabbi Reich was just out here.
Wow, okay. So, and they have different beliefs on how one should learn and how much time one should spend. And I guess the biggest difference with Eishet Torah is that, and what people disagree, is that since there's a Holocaust loss of humanity, of Jews just disappearing from the planet, then amateurs need to be somehow involved in Kiruv as well. Whereas the other organizations say, no, you have too much to learn, and let the experts handle Kiruv. That's probably the difference, the biggest difference in philosophy. But as far as what people learn and how much they learn and how much they devote to their own learning, that's also a difference. Asia actually has become, in the last 10 years, much more like the others. It wasn't when I first started, it wasn't 15, 20 years ago when it was first started. Yeah. So there's different understandings of how one makes up for those 20, 30 lost years. Right? That's a whole different question. Most commentators are not discussing that. They're talking about, because that's not the average person. You know, for every Baal Tshuva, there are a dozen or two dozen people who have always been from. And so the question becomes, is when do you start teaching this? When do you start teaching this? You know, at what age is Mishnah relevant? Is important? At what age is Gemara? And how do you, and which Gemara do you teach first? And, Rabbi Goldberg asked the Shiloh, because it's almost universal that the first Gemara that's taught to kids is Eilu Metzius, which is, it's the Gemara of, it's not what two people have, it's Eilu Metzius, things that are found, things that are lost. Mm-hmm. And one of the most difficult sugyas, one of the most subjects in all of Shas, and people will tell you, is in there. And that is something called Yeush Shlomidas. You know, something that Yeush means you've forlorn, what's that better word for them? It's you've given up hope of having, like, let's say you left a sweater in the New York subway. As soon as you realize you lost it, forget it. Right? You know, so from the moment you actually did lose it until the moment that you realize that you lost it is a gray period, right? You don't know that you lost it yet.
Right.
Right? So it could be 2 minutes, it could be an hour and a half, it could be whatever, it could be the next day. Right? So what is the status of that sweater during that period of time? That's called Yeush Shalomidas. Yeush, and I'm not conscious of it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the whole discussion on this, it goes on for pages. So, and that's almost always the first Gemara that's taught to kids. And Rabbi Goldberg thought, this is like, you know, the concepts in English, in any language, are very difficult concepts, for adults even. Because it really is a very tricky one. So he wanted to know, he asked a Gadol, to Gadolim, if he could start with something else, which is on Brachos, because everyone can relate to Brachos, right? As the first one, and then go into that. Or Eliyahu was different in that regard. That's the first thing Aaron learned. And then they quickly went to Eilu Metzius and everything, all the other usual standard yeshivish tractates. That's an example of a question that the Gedolim have to answer, as we have such a strong track record of what comes first, what comes second, what comes third. that even to vary off of that, you have to ask a Gadol, you know, if it's okay to do that. It's like, you know, I don't want to rock the boat too much. You're asking about a more difficult question, because everyone comes to Frumkeit, A, from different backgrounds, B, with different, very different intelligent levels. Some people speak a little Hebrew, some people know no Hebrew, zero, can't tell an olive from a base. Your brother-in-law, you know, Michael, he didn't know Hebrew at all for a number of years after. He already was keeping Shabbos, but he never learned Hebrew. Never. I mean, it wasn't his fault. He's never exposed to it. Right? And he's remarkable. He taught himself Hebrew, and he had to be very, very patient with himself. So you can't flog yourself for things that you haven't, not our fault. In a way, I didn't have a choice of how I was going to be brought up, and whether I should go to Hebrew school, or which Hebrew school I should go to, or whether to keep kosher or not. No, that wasn't my choice. My parents didn't ask me my opinion. Right? And so therefore, it really depends on so many factors, that every person is different. I don't think you can make rules. You know, and it's usually two tracks simultaneously, one or three. One is the whole socialization aspect of it, the keeping of Shabbos, to be with other Jews, that you see the whole world. Two is learning halacha, because you got to know what to do. And three is learning skills, learning how to learn. And all three have to happen almost simultaneously, and then therefore one of the big risks is, since you're learning halacha without learning any background for it. By the way, it happens with kids too. It does happen with kids, because kids will obviously learn halacha. They'll see your parents doing things. They'll know it's supposed to light candles. You're not supposed to make it. And they're certainly not learning Mishnah yet. They're like 3-year-olds. No, they're supposed to light candles on Shabbos. They don't know what Gemara is yet. Okay, so there's going to be, for adults and for kids who are first being exposed to this world, they'll see that there, and so therefore it's an important issue in chinuch, is to teach them this is like there's a connection. It's not, these are not arbitrary laws. There is an absolute connection, Torah, Gemara, Rishonim, Halacha. It's just a straight line. And they don't have to know maybe all the details, but at some point I think it's important that they have to understand, if for no other reason. A good Rebbe, I remember once, years ago, I went to Rabbi Sauer's Gemara Shir in Yula. I took 2 weeks off, and I couldn't go to Israel for a variety of reasons, so I went there. He was remarkable. I mean, he literally would start with the Gemara, and then he would go to the back of the Rosh. He would look at the commentators on the Rif, rather. Okay, and then he would pull out the Shulchan Aruch, oh, look, it makes sense. It's all remarkable. Yeah. And it's worth doing that once or twice, just to see how, it really all kind of puts together.
He's like, off the charts, he's a sharp guy.
Oh, gosh, yeah. But it's...
I went to a debate with him. He debated a secular judge.
Really?
I'm in the bankruptcy field, so he debated Judge Barry Russell, mm-hmm. at the Simon Wiesenthal Center on the halakha of bankruptcy.
Really?
Rabbi Sauer and him went back and forth. It was real interesting how much halakha law is involved in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
It was blown away. Interesting discussion.
It's good that you went to that.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
It's good that you went to that. I would be lost. But I usually am lost. I'll tell you this, Rabbi Sauer, I went to him. We had a question. What was the question? It's worth. Oh, come on. It was in the parsha this last week. Oh, I hate this.
Blessings?
No. Oh, the name Yisachar. Okay, one of the names, Leah's, right? One of the names of Leah's last one? No, she had Leah had 4, all right? And then later on she had more children than she had Yisachar and Zvulun. Okay? And so she had 2 more, Yisachar and then Zvulun. Yisachar's name is actually spelled Yisachar. It's like, it's Yud,
yeah.
Sin, Chaf, Resh. And you'll never hear it pronounced except once. Did you come to hear the Torah reading?
I was just wondering why they didn't pronounce it the way it's written.
They did. The first time it's read, it's supposed to be pronounced. The minhag is the first time it's read, uh-huh. that is when she names him Yisachar, it's read Yisachar.
Uh-huh.
And for the rest, and for after that, it's always Yisachar.
Why?
That's the question I had. Yeah. So I knew that that was the minig.
Uh-huh.
I remember learning it once, and I forgot where and how. So I go up to Rabbi Sauer, he has a Mikros Gedolos in front of him. Mikros Gedolos is, you have him up there, right there. And it's, and that's okay. Well, then I'll try to find it. 9:30. So he says, oh, good question. So he says, you know, the, and he says, so-and-so brings that down. He says, and he brings down the Das Sakim and flips open. Think about how he like, three flips and he's there. Right, that's the first thing.
Yeah.
And I've seen him do this often enough to know that it's not just like,
it just happens. He doesn't get lucky.
He doesn't get lucky. It's always right there. And he says, right here, and I'm like, my jaw's dropped already, right?
Yeah.
And then he says, right here, you'll see this, it's like anything. He gives me the whole answer, and there it is. And like, I've been astounded so many times that I'm not astounded anymore. It's like, there it is again. How does he know this? He knows everything by heart. It's staggering how much he knows. But, he was going to go into medicine. Do you know the year tell you this?
My father-in-law told me about it.
Yeah? Yeah. He actually wanted to go into medicine. And then he found out that a Kohanim have a real hard time with being in hospitals. You know, and you can do it, but it's not easy. It's not easy. So it does. But that's one of the reasons he's always been, he knows a lot about bioethics, you know, medical bioethics. And he's, because he's always had a fondness for that topic. He's really like one of the real experts in that area. Anyhow. Okay, so next time we'll start with the Shulchan Aruch. We'll end with the local commentaries, but we'll, among other things, we'll talk about Hasidus, because that was, you know, the most important break that's kosher break, and then to understand the times, it'll be the most history that you'll get, because I think it's very important to understand the historical context of when Hasidus began, to understand why it started, and the reason that's important is because Ashkenaz today is not Ashkenaz back time at the time of the Vilna Gaon, much because of Hasidus. We've drifted Ashkenaz also. Luis, I'll speak for Ashkenaz, but Ashkenaz has drifted towards Hasidus more, and vice versa. Hasidus, when it first, like first two generations of Hasidus, you would not recognize it. Okay, even if you were very close to people Hasidim, they were just, I mean, other than the dress and the attire, you would not recognize them at all. They hardly learned Gemara. The first two generations, or not, you know, basically didn't emphasize it in their schools. So, but that's no longer the case, and it's important to recognize how similar we are from how different there is. Okay.
Cool.
Okie doke. Very good. So we did well. It's like I should know this is. I put it in seven because it takes seven.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you
so much.
You're very welcome. Wow. You're welcome. Put it all away. Yeah.
Thank you for letting me get excited. I really get excited about this stuff. And it's interesting. You know.
Oh, it's great. How did you explain the difference between Rishonim and Acharonim? All right.
Don't be mad all week, at me. Right?
Don't be mad at me. I was struggling. It's already hard for me.
I'm not mad. I kind of hinted at it.
Okay.
I didn't mention the point. I said, what's special about
Hush. Please tell me to stop.